Welcome to Inflection Point Podcast, where our mantra is cultivating change from the inside out. Join your hosts, Anita Russell, Mavis Bauman, and Gail Hunter, as we create a brave space for conversations about racism, personal transformation, and accountability. Conversation provides a means to dive deeply into your thoughts, ideas, and beliefs, and examine what emerges in your words, actions, and behaviors. The show is a journey towards anti-racism by cultivating change within yourself first and then out into the world. Learn to engage in racial dialogue using four tools: courage, conversation, relationship, and accountability. Discover how truth, reconciliation, and healing can emerge from honest and deliberate conversations. Manifest social change right now on Inflection Point Podcast. Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Inflection Point Podcast on Transformation Talk Radio. I'm your host, Anita Russell, and here's a quick hello from co-host Mavis and Gail.
Hi, I'm Mavis. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Gail, and welcome to here, and glad you're here to be with us today.
Excellent, excellent. So I'm going to deviate a little bit from the normal way that we proceed, because I'd like to make share a couple of thoughts on the recent mass shooting in Buffalo, New York. The other day I read a poll on CNN where they were kind of putting out a call for people to call in and give their responses to a particular question. And the question that they posed was this: as a Black American, how does the Buffalo shooting make you feel about everyday activities? So it took me a minute to kind of think of what my answer to that question would be. And that answer is, it's the same way I feel about the historical and generational trauma from genocide, massacres, lynchings, and shootings that have occurred in this country, all in the name of white supremacy. And it's about robbing some human beings of their fundamental birthright to simply exist in the skin in which they were born. So I say that the question is somewhat shallow. A better question could be posed to white Americans. How does it make you feel that some human beings are denied their fundamental right to exist in the name of white supremacy? I agree with Kyle Williams, founder of A Long Talk, who said, "White supremacy is the enemy to us all, and we are in a state of emergency." 10 human beings killed and 3 wounded because one man decided that they did not have the birthright to freely and peacefully exist in the skin in which they were born. We say their names in honor of that fundamental right to exist for all of us. Roberta A. Drury of Buffalo, New York, age 32. Marcus D. Morrison of Buffalo, New York, age 52. Andre McNeil of Auburn, New York, age 53. Aaron Salter of Lockport, New York, age 55.
Geraldine Talley of Buffalo, New York, age 62. Celestine Cheney of Buffalo, New York, age 65. Hayward Patterson of Buffalo, New York, age 67.
Catherine Massey of Buffalo, New York, age 72. Pearl Young of Buffalo, New York, age 77. Ruth Whitfield of Buffalo, New York, age 86.
And those wounded: Zaire Goodman of Buffalo, New York, age 20. Jennifer Warrington of Tonawanda, New York, age 50. And Christopher Braden of Lackawanna, New York, age 55. We offer our condolences to the families, the friends, and the entire Buffalo community. So now I'd like to get to what this episode is all about. So our topic is Being Black Globally, Musings from an Intellectual Brother. And our question is, how do you remain true to yourself while moving in social and educational spaces that harbor the legacy of structural and institutional racism? And we are very fortunate to have a really special guest today, and we're going to talk about his background, some of the work that he does. His name is Mr. Corbin Swain, and I'm just going to read his bio real quick. Mm-hmm. Corbin Swain is a PhD candidate in biological engineering, working in the laboratory of Professor Ed Boyden at MIT. He is developing new microscope systems to image and study brain activity in small organisms. Corbin is committed to mentoring students from diverse backgrounds through his work as a facilitator for the MIT Talented Scholar Resources Room and a teacher for the Seminar XL program. He also attends the annual Biomedical Research Conference for minority students each year to meet and recruit students to MIT programs and graduate departments. Outside of research, Corbin enjoys photography and traditional photographic printmaking, and his poetic words are just as powerful as his photography, making him the epitome of an intellectual brother. So welcome, Corbin.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Glad to be here.
Excellent. Excellent. So why don't we start the conversation off by you just giving us a little bit of your history, your background, where'd you grow up, and all that sort of thing.
Yes, yes, definitely. And thank you for having me today. I think I'll go into a bit of my personal history, but I think in thinking about my own background, there's actually a poem that I've written called The Silence of Michael Brown. And the beginning of that poem goes through names from when I was born until present day of people who've been slain, Black people who've been slain, mostly by law enforcement. Taisha Miller, Amanda Aljalo, Sean Bell, Katherine Johnson, Tariqa Wilson, Oscar Grant, Tamir Wright, Michael Brown, so many names. And so I think as much as I have my own personal story, I think so much of that has been defined by interacting with the news and the reality, the story, the trauma, the triggers, both nationally, internationally, and personally, of systemic and acute violence against Black people. So I think, and I appreciate you all taking the time to say the names of those in Buffalo. But stepping from there and knowing that that's critical, I am a native of Huntsville, Alabama, born and raised. And I think I really had the privilege of growing up and being founded in kind of the Black church. Both my parents went to church. I was part of a historically Black Baptist church, one of the oldest in the city, first Missionary Baptist Church, and also two HBCUs in the city, with one of them being right down the road, Oakwood University. And so I think that was kind of my culture, and people always ask me, are you from Huntsville? Are you from Alabama? What are all your encounters with racism? And I think that I'm really thankful that like that was not a core experience when I was growing up. And I really had a chance to just be incredibly curious. My mom always tells this story of how when I was maybe 3 or 4 years old, I was asking about a telescope. And they had never mentioned a telescope to me. And so I fell in love with science and engineering from a very young age. That's something that I've always been interested in. And I think that interest has grown and grown. In high school, I was part of an engineering program. I was also able to do different experiences at Vanderbilt, Auburn University, other schools, just really getting to dive into what it means to be a scientist. Inventor was kind of my, what do you want to be when you grow up? I wanted to be an inventor. And you mentioned kind of intellectual brother, and that's another poem of mine. And it kind of talks about a tension that I had as I was growing up, where I really wanted acceptance from my Black peers and Black family and being like super interested in science and academics. But I also wanted, I was also interested in dancing and rap music, and I didn't want that to be the only thing that was associated with me being Black. And so I think there was very much a kind of learning how to navigate and finding people who affirmed, all of me, and also trying to ask people to step into affirming all of me was something that was big for me growing up.
So tell me a little bit about, as you were traversing all of these different spaces, because you've named quite a different, a number of different spaces, what were some of the things that sort of occurred to you that you might be a little bit different from other people? Because you and I, when we were talking earlier, I had shared with you that I had that same kind of interest in science. And, I was the kid that had the chemistry set and, the goggles and the lab coat and all of that. And so, but I went to art school and I studied interior design. So it's just this nice mixture of these different types of interests. And so if you could talk a little bit, share a little bit more with our audience about how all of that developed and how did it show up and what were some of the experiences that you were having as it showed up? Because I know you also had shared a story about your high school teacher and your interest in photography.
Yes. I think it showed up in a lot of different ways. I'm very thankful. I went for first through eighth grade, I was in two different private schools. And so in middle school, I was actually able to be a part of this group called Science Olympiad. And so we were on a team, but not to do sports, to like solve science puzzles or build robots and different things. And so I think that was something that was really fun. But then, I also was really into, I did track in middle school and kind of enjoyed that aspect too. And I think coming, as you mentioned, in high school, I was able to get exposed to the art of photography. And I had this absolutely incredible teacher who basically took us and taught us how to develop pictures from pinhole cameras, working in the dark room, traditional printmaking, developing film. And I think something that's kind of a through line throughout all of my experiences is just this opportunity to create or be creative. And so whether that's, learning how to excel, in running form and how to get a certain way, or learning in my photography work, how do you craft a perfect kind of print, or learning in engineering, how do you design a system that accomplishes the goal? And I think like that process of learning and creating and that rhythm has drawn me to a lot of different things. And then, as you know, kind of alluded to, in my senior year of high school and first year of undergrad, I got exposed to poetry, and specifically spoken word poetry. And what are all the ways you can write and speak and move your body to convey messages and like get emotions out and connect with other people too? Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. So Mavis, I know you want to comment about the photography aspect, considering the fact that you're a photographer yourself.
Sorry, I'm muted because I have a puppy stepping around. Sorry. Yes, I looked at your photos and I love them. And the black and white medium is just so gorgeous. I never developed photos myself. I kind of got started in the digital age. So I envy that as well. I just think it's so interesting that all of these interests crossed your paths. And Corbin, I was thinking about how common is that for, let's say, people in the Black community. For example, in my part of the country, no one had ever been out of the country. No one had had a car stolen. You know, so things were kind of geographic matters and issues of just accidents of birth. You know, it sounds like if your mom is giving you a formula in church to solve, I just think that is such an incredible, nurturing, exciting thing. So, you know, can you just kind of, do you have a big sense of that contrast, or do you, you know, the other books I read from people who have very different experiences, it's just so contrasty, you know, in the hood, you know, running for their lives half the time. So how do you contrast those things? And that relates to the question I had, which I was had almost lost. I think my white friends would not understand, at least in the Midwest, the term intellectual brother. So maybe Anita or Corbin can actually explain that. I just love the sound of it.
Oh, yes. No, thank you for those questions. I'll start with the with the first one. I think, I think it's the reality that, you know, Blackness is really just a rich fabric, right? Some people will refer to it as like the diaspora, referring to like the greater kind of immigrant, in addition to, you know, in the States, you have descendants of slaves. But I think there's so many different experiences. And I think I cannot speak to an experience growing up in the hood and, you know, having to, you know, physically fear for my life and deal with certain types of things. I think I recognize that that is a picture. I recognize that that is in some ways a stereotype. And I recognize that that is a very real material struggle. And I think I have to recognize my own privilege and opportunity that I've had access to. But at the same time, I think it's still a rich part of, you know, what it means to be Black, what it means to be Black in America. Mm-hmm. And so, and I think that's something I've struggled with, is like, am I still fully Black? Am I still able to like claim this if this isn't my story? And then the answer is a resounding yes, as encouragement to myself and others. And I think I just have to learn how to hold other stories as real and identify with them and also see where they're different. And I think this really connects to the term intellectual brother.
Exactly. Where
I think it's very much, and it's not to even put a dividing line, right? No. To talk about what it takes to survive in the hood, to talk about what it takes to toe the line in different, you know, mixed spaces, to talk about what it means to just be curious and want to learn regardless of what you have access to. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of the intellectual brother. And I personally have even distanced myself from the term because I think it puts a little too much black and white, because I think it's just a more richness of identity and the change that we see throughout life. Mm-hmm. And so I think, but that term for me really came from the tension that I had in high school, where, you know, I would want to go, you know, I don't even remember that dance, the Dougie or jerking. It was like 2010s. I love to do that. But then I also like love to be in, you know, my engineering class. And at the time, I didn't see pictures of that being intersected. So this was kind of the intersection for me. But as getting older, I'm realizing that, no, this is what many people were doing. And it wasn't just me. And so I think it was kind of that seeking out for that space and that affirmation is where that term landed for me.
And for me, that, because I'm a lot older than you are, Corbin. And so to me, that is a term that I kind of relate to from a different perspective, I think. And it's kind of like you, that term, it's kind of expressing the idea that there is no one way of defining you as a human being in Black skin. And I think that's kind of what we sometimes struggle with, is that there's so much about who we are that is monolithically ingrained in people's minds. And so for me, when I hear that term, it's kind of like an affirmation that you can be intellectual and go to MIT, but you can also sit down with people across the table in the Black community and have conversations. Though you may not have experienced a particular thing, just the fact that you are a part of that makes you a part of that community. And the intellectual part just comes, because I used to get it, oh, wow, she's one of them smart sisters. Mm-hmm. That's how I used to get it when I was growing up. But it wasn't a distinguishing, it wasn't a separating kind of thing. It was just distinguishing a certain characteristic of who I am and who I was as a person. So, and so it's complementary is what I'm saying. So that's how it always kind of resonated with me. So we're going to move on, actually, because I really want to start digging into the main question that we want to focus on here. And that question is, how do you remain true to yourself while moving in social and educational spaces that harbor the legacy of structural and institutional racism? Now, I'm asking that question from the perspective of the fact that you, Corbin, are a PhD student at MIT. And I recently read an article, or it was a letter that came from the president, Rafe, how do you pronounce his name?
President Rife. President Rife.
Okay, so President Rife's message, this was something that I read that was written around February of 2018. They have uncovered a range of evidence showing how MIT's early decades were shaped by the post-Civil War process of Reconstruction, from MIT trained engineers rebuilding the South's war-torn railroads to our links to many industries from mining to textiles that had depended directly or indirectly on labor from enslaved people. The students also found evidence of how the ugly racial attitudes of the day played out in student publications and even aspects of the curriculum. Perhaps the most jarring finding, an 1850 Virginia census document, which shows that before William Barton Rogers moved to Boston to found MIT, he and his wife Emma held 6 human beings as slaves. And so I've read articles from MIT, Princeton, and Harvard, where they're starting to really publicly recognize their institution as being directly sort of cultivated out of slavery and having, you know, enslaved people and that sort of thing. So the question that I have for you, Corbin, is how do you manage that as a PhD student in MIT? Yeah. And tell us about some of the activities that you're involved with that kind of fall into that space of acknowledging the real history of MIT.
Yes. That's big. Mm-hmm. I'll start with a quote that kind of stays in the back of my head, but it's from an article by Moten and Fred Moten, Stefano Harney, the University in the Undercommons. And so the opening paragraph starts like this. The only possible relationship to the university today is a criminal one. Continuing, certainly this much is true in the United States. It cannot be denied that the university is a place of refuge, and it cannot be accepted that the university is a place of enlightenment. In the face of these conditions, one can only sneak into the university and steal what one can, to abuse its hospitality, to spite its mission, to join its refugee colony, its gypsy encampment, to be in but not of. This is the path of the subversive intellectual in the modern university. And so I think I love this, kind of like the relationship one should have is one of theft. And it's kind of some radical language, but I think it gets at, we have to acknowledge, as the quote from President Reif does, the history of all of these institutions is to perpetuate some of the same types of, you know, unfortunately, white supremacist frameworks. The process of being professional, you know, I'm sure you've heard the things about hair, what's professional hair, being meritocracy, who actually has merit, who has access to merit, individualism, you know, pulling yourself up. All of these things are like foundations of what it means to be at a place of higher learning. And so I think I have to be critical of that and be aware of that going in, but I also have to be like deeply grateful for the investment that my parents have made in allowing me to be here. And so I think for me, the main way it looks to me is just building community. There are people here who are struggling. There are people who may not find themselves at home in a place like MIT, but can we create a space and carve out a pocket where, you know, we can be in community? So a key way for that was the Black Graduate Student Association, which is an organization I was the chair of for 1 year and served on another year. And I think just having place for people to like look at one another and say, was what just happened actually great? Am I crazy or was that problematic? And like for someone to say yes, like that's real. And I think to because there's so many, I mean, there's multiple times where I've walked, you know, in my lab building and someone's like, wait, why are you here? Why are you on this floor? I'm like, I'm a PhD student, you know? And I think it can be so hard to find that belonging. But I think community is a key way to really find that. That's and something that we can co-create, right? Coming back to that theme of creating together.
Knowing each other makes such a difference. Yeah.
Definitely.
Otherwise, we do stereotype. Yeah, seeing each other, proximity.
Really seeing each other.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And connecting the humanness between us all. Yeah. Yeah. Quinn, you wrote an article that I'd read earlier, not too long ago, on an Inquisition of Liberation. And I love how you talked about the difference between diversity and inclusion and equity and justice. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, because it's really brilliant. And you're right, we do need to focus more on the equity and justice. Definitely. Yeah.
And Corbin, before you jump into your answer to that question, we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, Gail, I want you to restate that question. Okay. And we'll have Corbin go into his answer.
Sure.
Tune in to the hit show, Us, Critical Conversations on the Challenges of Our Time, with me, Dr. Krista Lee Crane, on TransformationTalkRadio.com every fourth Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific. Listen while we focus on the intersections of truth and justice as we learn how to coexist, pushing our social transformation to the next level. Become true stewards of the justice that is needed in our world. Learn more at PreventionAgenda.org. That's PreventionAgenda.org.
Are you passionate about impacting social change or working towards anti-racism as a society? Are you willing to deconstruct your innermost thoughts, ideas, and beliefs about racism? Then Inflection Point Podcast, Cultivating Change from the Inside Out, is the show for you. Join Anita Russell, Mavis Bauman, and Gail Hunter in open, honest, and deliberate conversations every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, only on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Stuck in a roundabout of dysfunction? Learn how to speak your truth to power with host Dr. Kathy Aubert. Create real change with smart tools and smart strategies. No frills, no fluff, just life-changing conversations to help get you where you want to be. Extend your reach and become an agent for real change with Kathy Aubert. For more information on Kathy and her work, please visit drkathyaubert.com. That's drkathyaubert.com.
You've been listening, but are you watching? Tune in to your favorite shows on the Transformation Talk Radio Facebook page. We stream live video podcasts every day, and we love to hear from you. Leave comments and questions for the host to address live, on the air, and get to know the faces behind the voices you love. Just go to Facebook and search for Transformation Talk Radio.
Yeah, yippee skippy to that, baby.
Oh, self-care can be so much fun. And it's not just about bubble baths, but instead about prioritizing the wholeness of who you are without it taking a lot of time out of your day. I'm Claudia Sam, your Soul Connection coach, host of the Be Happy Now show. I invite you to put yourself at the top of the to-do list without guilt. Join me in the Soul Connector Circle community. Get daily pocket coaching and support to stay on track. Go to soulconnectorcircle.com and use the discount code RADIO.
So welcome back to Inflection Point Podcast on Transformation Talk Radio. Our topic for the hour is Being Black Globally, Musings from an Intellectual Brother. And we are entertaining the question, how do you remain true to yourself while moving in social and educational spaces that harbor the legacy of structural and institutional racism? And we have an incredible guest, Mr. Corbin Swain, PhD student at MIT, photographer, poet, and activist. And so at the break, Gail, you were asking a question.
Right. I was talking about an article that you had written and the difference between diversity and inclusion and equity and justice. And I was wondering if you could say more because it's really a fascinating article and a very much needed topic for, I think, everybody to look at a little bit differently that I think would be much more effective. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it was based off a quote from Professor D.L. Stewart. And I think, yeah, it's really important to get at that difference when we talk about diversity and inclusion, where we're asking who's in the room, right? Equity and justice is asking, you know, what does the room look like? How does it feel when people are in the room? What led to the room being this shape and size and have this history in the first place? And like, how can that be supplanted? And I think it's asking those deeper questions that is, it's something I try and enter into conversations with university administration along with other students about these things as well. And I think that's part of the, maybe you're aware of this, maybe you're not, but I think as Black students on a university campus, you become a de facto kind of advocate and you get pulled into meetings, asked to sit on platforms and committees, you know, by default. And I personally have to manage how much commitment I'm making, mm-hmm. as I think all of us do. But I think it's really important to push on that framing to mm-hmm. how expansively and structurally and deeply are we thinking about the surface level issues that we might see?
Definitely. And you talked about liberation. I don't know if you remember that. I'll quote you. I want us to see liberation as bound to the humanization of the most minoritized among us, even when it comes at a significant sacrifice of our own. That's exactly right. Yes, let's honor the marginalized, not on our terms, but in theirs. And I mean, it's beautiful. It's exactly what has to happen. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think just the radical understanding, radical empathy, mm-hmm. I think a willingness to do a lot more than the culture might demand. I think something I think about so often is just when, you know, there's an issue at a school or issue at a place. It's we want to bring in a committee or shift or have some type of meeting, but maybe the recommendation is to do less. Like maybe the school should actually be smaller. Or like maybe resource should be pushed into a completely different, or maybe the current leadership should just, you know, ask someone else to step into that role. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I'm getting, this self-sacrifice where we're saying, not just I want things to be better, but maybe I'm not the person to be doing this. Mm-hmm. And not in a way that says anyone is less than, but I think to more fully and embodied and in an embodied way recognize, I think, the truths and the justice that we're looking to exactly. to live out and see happen.
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
I think you're hitting the nail on the head because quite frankly, doing this work is very hard. Mm-hmm. And not everybody can pull that weight, if you will, mm-hmm. of doing yeah. this work in the activism space, in the anti-racism space. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's hard, and it's also continuous because it's a constant. We're constantly up against either this or we're up against that. We're up against this shooting or we're up against this issue mm-hmm. and all of that. So the battle is constant, and not everybody is cut out to really do this work. And I think it's important to your point, for individuals, mm-hmm. if you're not really cut out to do this work, that you do step aside yes. because you could end up being a hindrance to exactly. it all. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. That's
right. But as you say, Anita, sometimes we don't know what we don't know.
Yeah.
Even people with the best of intentions are pushing and they don't know what they're pushing for.
Right.
They appear to be helping or trying to help.
Yeah. And an important piece of that, and actually a very courageous piece of that, is when a person gets to the point where they can acknowledge, I really don't know.
Yeah.
And I need people like Anita or Corbin or Mavis or Gail to help me to understand, because I just don't know what you know and what you experience and that sort of thing. So it's a lot. So I'm actually going to shift the conversation a little bit. And we're going to talk about your activism through your poetry and mm-hmm. your photography. So how does activism for you, Corbin, intersect with your work as a photographer and your work as a poet? And I think somewhere in here, I would like to ask you to actually recite one of your poems.
Yes, definitely, definitely. I think the intersection has been very, very fluid for me. I think my poetry And really, I consider myself like spoken word, because I think there's something very specific about standing in front of people and saying it. That was really a space for me to find my voice. And I was in St. Louis in 2015 after the killing of Michael Brown. And I think processing what that meant for me. And, you know, I had friends messing me, are you okay? And everything. And like processing how I was feeling really came through poetry. And I think, you know, and even as we started this the podcast today, I think just the names and like holding those as sacred is something that, that poetry has given me. And not just as a list to recite, but as like actual people, actual stories, actual realities to hold. I think it gives me a platform to speak and give name to emotions that can be really hard and really raw. A lot of my poetry is very visceral and emotional. And I think it's part of my own processing, but also kind of a communal catharsis as well, that I think I'm thankful and to have my poetry serve in that way for myself and others. And I think for photography, I really see it, I think, as a creative work. And I think there's ways where it's intersected. But I think it's really an opportunity. I love to just capture people in the moment as they are. And especially through portraiture. And so I think being able to create a relationship and connect with people and share who they are, what they look like, a moment in time, a narrative, I think is really big as well.
Mm-hmm. I love that part of it too, Corbin. I should show you a couple pictures I took of Anita when we were in Rwanda together, just being greeted by the Rwandan survivors and the joy and the, you know who I'm talking about, Leonira, right?
Yeah.
It's such, it's just a rush to catch something like that. You cannot stage it. You can't expect it or anything, but you just watch, right? You just watch what's going on. Easier to be behind the camera, right, Corbin?
Yeah.
So what poem are you going to do for us?
So, yes, we're on the theme of, I think, thinking about what it means to exist in the school and, you know, process moving in these spaces that harbor the history. And I think something that has been a very unfortunate, consistent experience for me at schools has been instances where there'll be some type of racist output, be it a post or some type of interaction, experience with campus police or like a theme at a party or something. And that will happen on campus and the university will respond and they'll get kind of brushed over. And I think highlighting that for Black students on campus, these are like continued, very traumatic events. That you might say, or a campus might say, this is home for you, but it doesn't feel like home. So I'm going to read a poem called On Campus Security. It's based on an email that was sent out advertising an MIT party. And the email repeated the phrase, average Black male around 5'6" wearing a blue backpack 9 times as a joke throughout the email. And an apology was made, but I think that phrase and the way it was in jest and kind of just commodified Black criminality as a theme for a party, it was very hard for me and other students on campus to hear. And so this poem, I basically took the exact text of the email and replaced every instance of average Black male around 5'6" with a different word or set of words to create a story. So yes, I'll read this poem. You're walking in the halls. There's no one around and the lights are out. Out of the corner of your eye, you spot it. Racism. It's following you about 0 feet back. It gets down on all fours and breaks into a sprint. It's gaining on you, concealed, as an honest mistake. an unvetted email. You're looking for your room, but you've locked yourself out. It's almost upon you now, and you can see there's its face on its face. My God, its face is everywhere, running for your life from the empty promise of diversity and inclusion. It's louder than the pipes. You're not welcome here. Lurking in the shadows, recurrent door surfer sloshing from the streets of America onto the halls of MIT. Living in the basement. William Barton Rogers and the enslaved people his family owned. Searching for a Nelly? Cause only a student ID can unthug the black man, put it on a slingshot, actual cannonball, iron skin too thick to let this come between me and my degree. Now it's dark. You seem to have lost it, but you're hopefully lost yourself. Stranded with a stranger, you creep silently through the trash chute. Aha! There, in the distance, a small hatch with a light on. Hope! You stealthily move toward it, but your leg, it's caught in our shit, gnawing off your leg. Quiet, quiet, limping to the hive mind. Quiet, quiet. Now, you're sitting at our party, sitting inside a lie instead of a home.
Oh.
That's incredible.
That is absolutely incredible.
Thank you.
So true. Yeah.
Visual. It's visual.
And it connects to the emotion, like
it's a heart.
You know, like a person that CNN, what I mentioned earlier. So how do you feel about this particular thing? But it's not just that particular one.
Yeah.
It's the whole concept of racism. And I love the way you depicted it as something that is constantly chasing us down.
Right.
And we're constantly trying to figure out how to dodge so that we don't get caught up in the fire.
Right. And not even knowing what you're dodging, not even knowing what it's going to look like, right? And where it's going to come out. I mean, yeah.
But even with not knowing, you know it's always there.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
The possibility of it pouncing on you is always there.
Mm-hmm. It's walking through life, always having that fear, that awareness, that fear, right? When's it going to happen? How's it going to happen?
I don't see it as fear. Like, I don't walk out my door every day fearful of what could happen. But I do walk out of my door every day cautious.
Yeah.
Just being very cautious. And, you know, I was explaining to Mavis earlier, I use Uber a lot. So when I get in an Uber car, I get an instant feel for what's the vibe inside this car. Mm-hmm. Is this vibe going to be friendly? Is this vibe not going to be friendly? And by the grace of God, I've never had an unfriendly Uber incident or anything like that. But your radar is just always on because you just don't know. But you still have to walk through spaces. You still got to do your life. You still got to do your photography. You got to be in your lab. You got to be in all of these different places. And so you can't allow the racism to destroy you.
Right? Doesn't feel like a little bit like a hypervigilance. Like you have to have that conscious awareness a little bit of wherever you are and whatever you're doing, you know, and that's where the trauma comes from, right? That it's a trauma reaction.
Yeah. And they talk about, right, life expectancy.
Right.
Absolutely. It's a very powerful concept.
Sure, that level of stress, the depth of that. I mean, that's living with that always. It's always there.
It's always there. Like I think about, you know, I have my grandson Kyra, but I also have my grandson Zane, who's 14.
And very tall.
Him, like in the back of my mind, I'm always saying a prayer over him. Keep him safe.
Yeah.
Just keep him safe. Yeah. Like whatever space he's in, just let it be a safe space.
Yeah.
Like unconsciously, it's there.
Right. And the one poem that you wrote, where you talked about your friend and his daughter, can you say, because that's perfectly what we're talking about, is being safe. It's heart-wrenching, but yes. Mm-hmm.
Were you asking me to share about that?
Well, just that if you wanted to, but it's just it reminded me of that what she wrote about, right? That how the little girl, the 6-year-old, was so joyful, happy in her day was daddy came home safe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And
no child should have to have that be the highest point of their day. Right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Corbin, I have to ask you, do you feel really free to speak at MIT about these issues, and have they ever pushed back at you on any of your articles, or how do they respond, the board, whatever?
I think there's I'm not the most kind of forward pushing for the people who have asked me to speak or asked me to share. And it's like, if you're asking me to come, I'm not going to pull any punches. You know, I'm just going to try and speak. And I think people on the surface, I think folks are willing to hear it. And I think especially in kind of the post 2020 timeframe, you know, that summer and the months after, I think there was a deep desire for people to want to hear and maybe get some of that. I think it's different to like listen and give platitudes versus to actually ingest and say, wait, this actually has ramifications for the way I operate or move. And so,
you mean what you say?
Yeah. The things that I say.
It has ramifications.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Whereas the whole diversity, I can say diversity, justice, equity, inclusion. We can add that to the title of the office, but has the ethos of the campus office for diversity and inclusion actually shifted to represent those values?
Right, right. Can you live in that space?
So I think that's where there can be a lack of listening.
Mm.
I mean, it's so many schools, institutions where, and it's given name, but in practice,
right,
you don't always see
it. If the energy in that room or space, you're not living in it, then they're just words, right?
I just keep trying to get a sense of how big and intractable racism is. You know, how much do the people in power, white people, want to hang on to it to the point where there's still little microaggressions of shaming, or I saw this article, yeah, you need to relax. I think you're right. I mean, I'm just seeing and reading so much more since 2020. But, there's got to be some shame there. Or maybe the administration now is so removed from it, they're not concerned about that. I don't know. I just was curious. You know, at Fletcher, they're all about that and have been since their inception, you know. Just about the world, So, yeah.
I think, and yeah, feel free to let me know how we're doing on time.
Yeah, we're at, we have about six minutes to go. And I really want to make sure that in that time, I want you to talk about your, the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday and that particular picture that you took, because I think even though the audience won't be able to see the picture unless it's something you can pull up real quick.
I can pull that up. Yes.
Yeah, that would be great. But if you could just maybe for like a minute or two talk about what were the circumstances of that image.
Yeah. So I had the chance to be in Selma, Alabama for the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, where they crossed the Edmund Prentice Bridge in the first attempt to march all the way to Montgomery. And so I took a series of photos during my time there. And so this is an image of kind of the large crowd that was, that was gathered, and President Obama was going to speak that day. And kind of one of my favorite images was of these two men who were just present in the crowd. And they were looking actually at the scene I just showed you. And I asked them to look off at the bridge and took their photo. And I think it just captures the, I think, the gravitas of that moment and all of us being there. And then here's another image of my mother that I was able to capture, where we were in this sea of people walking across the bridge. And it was just an incredibly powerful experience. And these images will definitely stick with me for a long time.
You can see in their faces, and even your mother, the intensity of what everybody and the depth of what was being felt there energetically, even emotionally. Yeah, it was just incredible pictures.
So we're down to 2 minutes. Corbin, if there's any thing that, is there a website or whatever that you want to call out that our audience can go and visit and learn more about you, learn more about your work, your photography, and all that?
Definitely, definitely. I would say Instagram is my main social media. So you can follow me at Corbin Swain and at Corbin Swain Photo. And we were speaking on activism today, and I really just want to take 30 seconds to talk about a kid named Moses Harris, who was disappeared in Northern Mass into the Concord River, December of 2020. And so the family has been going through so much, and I've been in the streets with the family for about 6 months in 2021. And so his body was found 6 months later, but it was after an encounter with the police, and the family is still searching for answers. And these are one of those stories that you just don't hear about because it's not clear cut enough. There's no video. And so we're asking folks to call Rachel Rollins' office and just asking folks to read into the story of Moses Harris in Lowell, Massachusetts. That's another.
Do you have a phone number for Rachel Harris?
I don't have that phone number, but it's Rachel Rollins, the U.S. attorney for the District of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Yeah.
We're down to 1 minute, and I'm your host, Anita Russell, and you can find out more about the work that I do on theplacetosoar.com. So Mavis Gale, if you could kind of call out your information.
Sure. I just got to thank Corbin again. Thank you so much. This is just such a lovely way to interact and learn. My organization is Seed a Better Life. You can find it on seedabetterlife.org. It is an organization to support the education of people in Rwanda affected by the genocide.
Excellent. Gail?
And thank you, Corbin, for being here. This has just been amazing. And I'm so grateful to have been able to meet you, even just for a short time. OmaPittsburgh.org is a website for the nonprofit that I run, and we do holistic education. We do a lot of trauma-informed training, and we have a program for youth. So check it out. We have a lot of different interesting things that we're doing. Thank you.
Excellent. So thank you so much, Corbin Swain. You've been an incredible guest, and I thank you for the work that you do, and I'm looking forward to some of those things that are going to come out of your research as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
This
I'm going on Instagram.
Yeah, this is Anita Russell signing off from Inflection Point Podcast on Transformation Talk Radio, and we will see you next time.
Thank you for listening to Inflection Point Podcast, where our mantra is cultivating change from the inside out. The journey towards anti-racism and social change doesn't stop here. Truth, reconciliation, and healing come from ongoing, open, honest, and deliberate conversations. Continue to dive in and deconstruct your thoughts, ideas, and beliefs as we band together to manifest social change. Tune in to Inflection Point Podcast every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, here on TransformationTalkRadio.com for more conversations about how we can cultivate change from the inside out.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.